you know, this particular industry is really tough. I mean, there is no warm leads. No one's filling out a web form. You know, we're not marketing to people. We're literally cold calling farmers, selling them tools for high prices that they don't need. So you got to be a shark. There's just no way around it, right? And I did that from 15 to 19. I ended up moving to another company, became a manager. And then at 21, I took off and did my own thing. And so what I did was I built a team of sales reps and I scaled that up to like 50, 60 salesmen. And then at one point later down the road, I ended up merging with the parent company that I was working under. And to this day, we're all still together.
JB is here in the Wolf's Den. I got a great guest today. Guy's in the sales world, a great closer, also in real estate. We're doing an event together. He's got a boot camp coming up in January, which is going to be incredible. So we're going to talk about that. Here we go with Chris Gomez. How are you, Chris?
Hey, good to meet you, man.
Good. So, Chris, you're, you know, it seems I'm getting a lot of people lately that, you know, they have this, the very common thread. They grew up really poor.
Right.
Like, you know, it's like yeah. Like the third person in a row. It's very interesting, right? I think it's really motivating for people to keep listening to people with a story of, like, you know, really from ultra rags, right, to riches. So why don't you tell me about, you know, just how poor were you, really? Yeah, you know, and guys, I guess I'm wondering what the barometer now is for, because everyone's telling me a very similar story. So how bad was it?
I mean, I was so poor for Christmas, we got, you know, videos of watching other kids opening presents.
We did the stand-up. But not like, you know, so... Are you from, what's your heritage?
Yeah, so my mom's from Portugal. My dad's from Mexico.
Okay.
I grew up in Ontario. And, you know, and I come from a really good family. We were just poor, right. You know, and, you know, when I grew up, it's like, I didn't even really realize I was poor until I got older. You know, we had such a good upbringing. But yeah, no, I mean, living in and out of hotels, you know, bouncing around, getting kicked out of school, all that stuff, because we never really had a stable residence. My parents are great people, love them to death. They're, you know, my dad works with me and my company now. I was able to retire my mom down the road. But back then, it's just we were struggling all the time.
Why do you think that was? What was it about? Was it a lot? You didn't speak the language, maybe? Was that part of it?
You know, yeah, my mom was born in the island. Right. So she came over with nothing, you know, and then my dad just kind of grew up in a poor family. So they never really had anything. And between the two of them struggling to work and just trying to do, like, you know, normal blue collar stuff, we just were always struggling to make ends meet.
Sure.
And then I think, you know, not having a stable residence was hard because, like, we'd move around from city to city and place to place, wherever the next job was. My dad was in construction a lot. So, you know, how that goes. It's like it's good when it's good and it's bad when it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a struggle. I mean, it's just it is what it is. But for me, I used it as motivation, you know, when I got older.
So you were basically living in motels and it was like, so was there food on the table and stuff?
Yeah, I mean,
for the most part?
There was and there wasn't, you know, at times it was tough and we'd go to, like, the Salvation Army and the Goodwill to get food and stuff. And my grandma would, you know, come in and bail us out sometimes. And then things would go good sometimes for like a year, you know, and then it would go bad again. Okay. It's just one of those, you know, same, like you said, the same story you hear over and over, you know, rags to riches type story. But back then it was just a constant struggle growing up. And it didn't really change till.
How old were you as a student?
You know, so I was actually a good student, but I just never made it to school a lot because, you know, we didn't have a car. So, and back then it's like, I'd have to, like, take the bus. And sometimes where we lived would be too far for me to walk to get to the bus, mm-hmm. you know, the school bus, right?
Sure.
So when I was in school, I did have good grades, but my problem was attendance. I was just never able to make it there all the time. I actually dropped out in ninth grade. To this day, I still don't have a diploma or a GED or nothing, no college education, no nothing. I actually dropped out of high school and got into the telemarketing game. And that's kind of what changed the whole trajectory of my life.
How old were you?
I was 15, about to turn 16.
Okay. And tell me about that.
So I answered an ad in the paper. I'll never forget it because it changed my life. But the ad said, "Hi, I'm Stupid Joe. I make $2,000 a week talking on the phone. If you're half as stupid as I am, you can make $1,000 a week. Please call." And at the time, I was like, shit, I'm stupid. All right, let me call, you know? So I called. I went in. I didn't even know what the job was, you know? And it was basically telemarketing, selling tools over the phone to farmers. And yeah, I mean, that's where I got my chops, you know? And that's what I still do to this day. That whole industry changed my life.
Okay. So tell me about, you walked into this room. Was it, you know, what was it? It was like a small, how many salesmen were there?
You know, the first place I started working at was a small company. There was like five or six guys.
Okay.
And, there wasn't really anybody doing anything big there, you know, but I got in and I, you know, I learned and, you know, we're basically selling tools and supplies to farmers and contractors and things like that. Right. So I did that from like 15.
And what was your pitch? Like, what would you say? You know, call someone phone and what would you say? Hey, I got a really good deal. And
yeah. You know, what we would do is we would always try to create some form of urgency. So we'd get the guy on the phone, we'd open him up, get him talking. And it'd always have some kind of reason why today was the day, right? Like, you know, right now we're liquidating inventory from a company that went bankrupt. It's almost like a act now kind of thing. Right.
Yeah.
Cause the, you know, this particular industry is really tough. I mean, there is no warm leads. No one's filling out a web form. You know, we're not marketing to people. We're literally cold calling farmers, selling them tools for high prices that they don't need. So you got to be a shark. There's just no way around it, right? And I did that from 15 to 19. I ended up moving to another company, became a manager. And then at 21, I took off and did my own thing. And so what I did was I built a team of sales reps and I scaled that up to like 50, 60 salesmen. And then at one point later down the road, I ended up merging with the parent company that I was working under. And to this day, we're all still together. It's crazy, huh?
Okay.
Yeah.
So, so you were a top salesman, right? Yeah. And what do you think it was? Was there a training program? Were you a natural born closer? Did you have any mentors? What were you using to, as your guiding light, so to speak, for sales? You just figured it out on your own.
Well, you know, I had some good training and I worked around some good guys, but in this particular industry, like, you know, the average deal is like $300-$400, right? Okay. You have to sell a lot of deals every day to make money. And, you know, back in the day when I was doing this and I was on the come up, one day, you know, I needed money. Like I said, I was poor, right? And I just thought to myself, why are we not trying to sell these guys bigger? You know, because nobody was doing it, you know? And this is, you know, 15, 16 years ago, right? So I was like, man, you know, nobody's pitching these guys big. And I knew we were calling farmers and I knew most of these farmers were wealthy. They own lots of land, they have money. So I was like, you know, I'm just going to start pitching these guys bigger. So I was like the first guy in this industry that really started pitching people for like 10,000, 15,000, 20,000. And eventually I started getting those deals and it pretty much revolutionized the industry.
So what did those different, obviously different type, bigger equipment and stuff?
More quantity of things, you know, like, you know, in the business, it's typical to call a guy and try to sell him a drill or sell him a set of drill bits or an air impact wrench. But I would call guys and try to pitch him a container of stuff. You know, and I'd say, hey, we're liquidating everything. I could tell you what I got, or I could just price you on the whole package if you want to take advantage of a big savings. You know, and I just start really pushing the big packages. But I realized right away that I was calling people that had money and they were almost turned off by some guy trying to sell them a drill, right? But some guy saying, hey, I got 10 grand worth of stuff you're going to use for 7 grand and pitching like a package deal.
Right.
I just started selling people and it just started, you know, it literally changed the industry. Next thing you know, I started training guys to do it. And then other guys were having success doing it. And then it just started booming and booming and booming.
And then eventually your next step was you started getting into real estate?
Yeah, that happened by accident. Actually, true story, happened by accident. You know, I was in the tool biz and at this point I was already doing well and making money. And my mentor, who's also my partner in the tool biz. Yeah, I call him my partner, but he's more like the boss, right? He basically told me, hey, man, you're making money. You need to go buy some rental properties or do something. So I didn't know anything about real estate, but he was buying rental properties. So I just wanted to copy what he was doing, you know? So I went and bought a couple properties and, you know, at the time, I didn't know what I was doing, so I did it all wrong. I just paid full price off the MLS, you know? Yeah. And after buying a couple of them, I was like, well, shoot, I'm gonna go broke doing this. You know, I gotta like make some more money. So I thought to myself, well, maybe I could flip a house and use that money to go buy the next rental, you know? Mm-hmm. So I started Googling and YouTubing and I ended up finding out about wholesale real estate, which is, you know, what I really started getting into then. This was, you know, about 4 years ago. Now we kind of hit it from all angles. We do wholesale and we do, you know, rehabs, or some people call them fix and flips, and we buy rentals. We do the whole thing. But at the time, that's how I got in. It was literally just YouTubing, trying to figure out how to flip a house. I was watching one of those TV shows, you know, like Flip or Flop or one of those, you know, and I was like, I could do this. But I ended up tripping across wholesale real estate, which, you know, is basically where you put a property under contract and you sell the paper, you know, you flip the contract without ever owning the house. And so I ended up building that company and now we have that company doing really well. And then I realized I had a niche for it and we're doing really well. So then that's what launched the events and the speaking and the training. And now it's just a giant.
So tell me about that. So let's go through the whole trajectory there. So,
okay. So I mean, with the events or?
Yeah. So you started training people?
Well, you know what happened was I started posting a lot of my success on Instagram. And people would reach out to me, hey man, you know, I'll pay you this if you can jump on the phone with me and tell me how to do this, you know? And at first I would just, oh yeah, I'll just tell you for free. And I'd hop on the phone with people and just give value and try to help people. And then, you know, I started recognizing a pattern, you know, all these people keep sending me messages saying they want to pay me for advice, you know? So I kind of embraced that a little bit. And it started off very, you know, slow. And then it turned into big. And then it was like, you know, I would train or help one guy. And 3 weeks later, he'd call me and go, oh, I just got my first deal, made $30,000. You changed my life, you know? And I just started kind of like, it took a life of its own. And when we decided to do the first event, the Accelerator, it was, at the time, you know, it was me and my marketing guy and my head of sales and my real estate company. We're sitting together and we said, hey, we should throw like a little mini event, like at a hotel and get like 20, 30 people there, you know, that could like come in, spend like a higher ticket price, and we can really train these people and see how it goes. So we built up a little hype about it on my Instagram. And then the day that we released it, we sold like $50,000 worth of tickets that day. And then I was like, oh shit, now we need to figure out how to throw an event.
What was the price of the ticket?
It was $5,000.
Okay.
Yeah, it was five. Well, there was two. It was a general admission at the time was like, I think $3,000, and the VIP was five. And I mean, we literally just did this not even knowing what we're doing, you know? But so many people bought tickets the first day, and we had such a big, you know,
for property sales.
To learn how to wholesale real estate.
Okay.
So, you know, let me take that back. The people that come to my event are people that are already wholesaling real estate, but they want to come learn how to be a better negotiator.
Okay.
So most of the people that attend the event are guys that are already six-figure earners, doing quite well, flipping houses, but they lack in the negotiation side. There's a lot of people out there teaching like marketing and, you know, that type of thing, right? But not a lot of people teaching how to negotiate with a seller, how to negotiate these deals to rock bottom, and then how to turn around and sell them for top dollar to a buyer, you know?
So why don't let's get into that. Let's talk about that right now. Let's go, like, from your perspective, Ab, you have a system that you've created for this?
Yeah.
So what would you say, like, is five steps to successfully negotiating a property? What would they be? What would be step one?
So step one would be opening, which, you know, would be to be specific, like building rapport, right? You know, doing your homework on who you're calling, you know, like if you came through my funnel, I would look you up on Facebook or Instagram, try to figure out everything about you before I called you. That way, when we get into talking, I know it's like, I got ammo, right? I can relate to you. I know what you like. I know what you don't like.
And what are some of the things that you typically find? Now, I mean, I'm probably not your average person you call. So like typical person, what are they like?
Well, you know, typical people post their whole lives on Facebook. I'm sure you'd agree. I'm just about everybody's all over Facebook. So when we look at people, you know, these are people that submitted our web form, right? Mm-hmm. I tell my guys, look at them first. See if you can find any kind of common ground to make conversation with. You know, do they like Trump? Do they hate Trump? Do they like dogs? Do they hate dogs? You know, do they have a Chargers jacket on? Anything, right? Kind of like we're gathering intel about who we're calling, right? Okay. So then when we call, you know, we try to keep it, you know, as organic as we can, but, you know, we talk and get the conversation rolling. And at some point, you know, we try to get the conversation going about the dogs or whatever it is that we've seen, you know, to build that instant connection, right?
Okay.
So step one would definitely be rapport and opening up the customer. Step okay. two, we move into what we call urgency. So, or we call it urgency or a now factor, but a reason why they got to make a decision now, because everybody wants to think about it. You know, selling a house is a big deal. Most people don't sell a house on impulse. You know what I mean? So we try to get them a little bit of urgency with, you know, it's the beginning of the month, it's the end of the month, you know, or we have money, we don't have money. There's always a reason why we got to get the deal done now. So we go opening, urgency. Then we go to, you know, like intelligence gathering. We got to find out about the property. Mm-hmm. And that we take our time on because we really want to make sure we're getting properties that are going to fit our end buyers well. We don't just want to like put properties under contract and waste people's time and then not be able to sell it, because then everybody gets pissed off, right? It's bad business. So we really take our time gathering intelligence about the property, trying to figure out what the situation is. Most of these houses have a situation. Tenants not paying. Someone died in the property. Someone's divorced or something like that, right? So yeah, we gather the intelligence about the, you know, the data about mm-hmm. the property, right? And then at that point is when it's time to start talking numbers. So most people that teach this in the industry, they teach what they call a maximum allowable offer, which means basically you take the value of the house, you minus out the repairs and the holding costs and all those things, and you figure out what's the most you could pay in order to get the deal and then sell it to somebody else. I don't really like that. You know, I was always taught that in negotiation, you know, you don't show your hand first. You always want to get the number out of the other party, that type of thing, right? And so we don't do maximum allowable offers. I train my guys to just be relentless in trying to get a number out of the seller. Because, you know, you never know what someone's willing to take. And to them, it's worth what it's worth. I mean, I tell people all the time, you're never going to get a $100,000 deal if you don't try to get a $100,000 deal. If you're always doing your maximum allowable offer and then trying to make 10 or 20 grand, that's all you're ever going to make. So what we do is we try to get to those numbers and we try to get it out of the other person. You know, what are you looking to get?
So you know what your maximum allowable offer is, but then you're going to make them hopefully come in with a much cheaper number, not negotiate against yourself, so to speak.
Exactly. At least get them to throw the first number. And it's like, in the industry, it's just not taught this way. And so all these people that I take under my wing, I teach them how to do it this way. And then all of a sudden they're having record deals, you know, like
So what percentage of the time does the buyer or the seller come in with an offer that's below that? So there is a pick. Is it common or is it rare?
It's not common, but when it happens, it makes up for a lot of them that didn't, you know? So like, I mean, an example would be like, sometimes we get landlords that are just tired of being landlords. They hate this house. Tenants not paying rent. They just want to get out of it. Right. And you know, there's times where we're negotiating and it's like, okay, so what are you looking to get for the place? Well, I don't know. You called me. I was hoping you're going to make me an offer. And then I come back, well, you know, we're investors. If I make an offer, we're going to start at $5 and go up from there. You know, and they laugh and I laugh, you know, and we just keep playing the game until they finally give me the number.
Right.
Usually when they give me the number, whatever it is, I already know no one's going to give their best number up front, right? I mean, there's some kind of an anchor of some sort, right? Mm-hmm. So then we re-anchor again even lower, but at least we got the first number out of them. You know, sometimes it works, sometimes it don't. But when it works, it's the home runs, the six-figure deals, you know, rather than like, you know, let me just figure out what's the most I can pay. You might tell someone, hey, I give you $550,000. Maybe they only wanted $400,000.
Right.
But you just don't know unless you get it out of them, right? So, you know, to sum it all up, I mean, that's what we try to teach at the event and with my students is how to get those numbers out of the people. And we follow that five-step formula, right? Opening, then we got like the urgency or the now factor. We got the data gathering. We got the numbers. And then it's time to close the deal, right? I mean, there's many steps inside the steps, right?
Sure.
But yeah, that's the basic formula.
Okay. And are there any types of properties that you think make the best investments, like certain number of units or certain areas or something you look for?
For us, we try to stay four units and down, and mainly at single family residences. I think the sweet spot for us is houses that are worth $400,000 to $1 million, like in that range.
Once so you like get Fannie Mae, so they're, you know, those type of loans.
That, and I think it's just because
conforming loans mostly.
I mean, well, for us, we sell them to the guys rehabbing them. We don't even deal with that part of it.
Okay, so you're out before.
We're out before, but I think we like those houses and those price points because once you get over $1 million. It's not that we don't do those deals, but you know, people that have a $2 million house usually don't want to give it away, so to speak, or they, you know, they might not be in the same financial situation as someone with a cheaper house, right? It's a bigger decision to cut bait with a $2 million house than a $500,000 house, right? So I think that's why. And in our backyard over here in Riverside, houses are, you know, usually less than $1 million just about anywhere. Mm-hmm. And they probably average $400,000 or $500,000.
What do you think about the importance of, you know, timing in terms of the market, that, you know, there are good times to invest in real estate, bad times? You think it's irrelevant? Just keep, stay the course, play for the long term. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I guess it depends on what area of real estate. So specifically with what I do with wholesale real estate, the market don't matter. It's more like running a pawn shop, right? It's like, people are always going to be getting in jams and needing to sell their
house. So you're just looking for distressed properties.
We're looking for, well, I mean, yeah, I mean, nobody else is going to want to sell a house for half of what it's worth, right? I mean, it's just like a pawn shop. It's the same reason you see Rolexes at a pawn shop. Someone got in a jam and they had to sell their watch fast. A lot of these people we deal with, it's divorce or bankruptcy or someone died or someone just inherited houses, you know, or foreclosure, some type of distress that makes them sell cheap.
So theoretically, logically, it makes perfect sense to me, right? I would think this is an incredibly crowded market, though. Like, in other words, aren't there just an astronomical number of people all trying to play the same game? It's not like something you invented, I mean, right? I mean,
right.
No, it's been around since I was a kid, you know, distressed real estate buying, right? I mean, there's funds that do it. People are waiting at the banks for all. I mean, it would just seem that it's not something, it's like, it seems like an easier said than done, because in the end of the day, it's always supply and demand, right? How many people are there that are, you know, really anxious to sell? And if that number is X, and if people are out there advertising this on the internet every single year, there's more and more people chasing the same amount of properties, it would just seem to me logically it would be very difficult to find these deals. Is that true or it's not true? It's actually very easy to find these deals.
It's definitely not easy. You know, it's definitely like any other business. You got to have strong marketing. And, you know, the big guys usually do well because they have the budgets for the strong marketing.
Explain that. What does define, you know, strong marketing?
You know, like being able to advertise in all areas. Like, so like in my company, we send direct mail. We advertise on Google. I'm constantly advertising stuff on Instagram. I have a cold call center.
Like, you know, saying, you know, hey, you want to sell your house fast? Need cash?
You
know, you're in trouble. Buy on your taxes or
right.
Blah, blah, blah.
The problem is that a lot of the new people that get in the game don't have the budget to really do mass marketing, right?
Okay.
So there is a lot of new people that, you know, they go to one seminar and they try to go get in the game and they kind of water the game down, like you're saying.
Right.
You know?
I'm just thinking intuitively, it would seem that there's like all these people. I know we're at the end of a long upward swing in real estate. Now, who really knows where real estate's going to go? You don't know.
Right.
It could keep going up, it could go down, but most of the people I speak to in the industry are saying the market's toppy right now. They suspect that it will pull back. Does that mean it will? Who really knows, right?
Yeah, right.
But That's what the smart money is saying. So typically the end of a run like that is when you see all the people now in the game trying to make money. It's right. Like I used to say, like back in the mortgage boom in the '80s, you know, in the 2008, right? It was the '80s too, but in 2008, like, you know, you'd be getting a haircut. And your haircut's like, oh, yeah, I just flipped my third house. And, like, you know, it's like, oh, I'm a mortgage broker, too. And right. Your limo driver's a mortgage broker. Your aunt's a mortgage broker. It's like,
everybody's in the game.
Right. Yeah. So that's sort of the end is nigh, right? And it would seem to me that I don't know if we're quite with that level right now, but I think that there's been a great run. And it's probably, it'll be a bit tough. But that being said, though, I mean, there are still deals around, right?
Oh, yeah. There's always deals because, like I said, it doesn't matter if the market's up, down, or sideways. People are always going to have problems.
But how do you essentially be the guy that beats the other people to the punch? Because I guess that's a big part of it is you got to get there first, right?
You got to get there first, and you got to be a better negotiator.
Right.
You know, because, I mean, I can't even tell you how many times we've called or we've had a lead that we've talked to, and they said, oh, yeah, you know, we had another company. They said they're going to come out, but then they rescheduled, da-da-da, and we just locked the deal up over the phone. We don't even go see the property. Mm-hmm. We do this virtually. Like, we flip houses all over California. We don't even go to the property.
All over just California or all over the country?
Right now, just California.
Why?
We were doing Florida for a while. I was doing Florida for a while, and then I had some properties in Ohio, but we're just doing too well here in our backyard.
How many properties are you flipping on average every year, every month?
This year will be over 100.
100 properties. And do you ever lose?
No, because we sell them to the rehabber. We get paid no matter what.
I understand. No, but you have to have possession for some amount of time, right?
Or no. So it's
you
like
not
this.
Even have possession.
No, so it's like this. Like, you have a house that's worth $500,000, but you're in a jam. I tell you, I'm going to give you $300,000. So we sign this contract that says you're selling me the house for $300,000. Then I call this guy and say, hey, I'm selling you this house for $350,000. He gives me $50,000, takes the contract. If it goes bad after that, it's on him. I made money just for sourcing the deal. So I have nothing to lose. No credit involved, no nothing. The only money that I'm gambling at all is the money I spend on my overhead and marketing and that type of thing. So as long as we're getting deals, we're always making money.
And again, just it's fine. Just intuitively, it sounds like it's too good to be true.
Yeah, well, yeah, it sounds easier than it is. that's what it's not too good to be true.
But 100 deals, that's a lot of deals.
A lot of deals.
All right. And, you know, I have some really good friends in this industry, like really successful guys. Some have been on this podcast. Josh Altman, for instance, you probably know. Josh is a good friend of mine, right? In fact, I'm dealing with him tonight, right? So you know, when I was talking to him about something like this, he said, you know, that's a little easy to do in a up market, in a declining market. It's really difficult to do. That was his take on it. You would disagree, though. You think it can happen in any market?
Yeah, no, I would disagree for sure. And the reason, I mean, here's the thing, right?
Sure.
When the market's going down, the only thing that changes for the wholesaler is that when we sell the property to the guy that's going to renovate it, he gets a little more conservative on his numbers.
Yeah, right.
Because he knows, hey, it's going down. Mm-hmm. But it all goes back to the negotiation. If I negotiate the deal cheap enough, the saying is, it's not hard to give away money, right? If I got a $500,000 house under contract for $300,000, someone's going to buy it. Now, the spread might go down.
Well, right, but the big if there is, like, again, we go back to this of, you know, how many, with so many people going out, they're trying to do the same thing. I guess there's that many distressed buyers out there, sellers out there?
I would say most new guys fail. That's the truth. Most people try to get into this and they can't do it. Or they get one deal and then they spend all their money trying to get the next deal. And then they realize...
Spend all their money meaning marketing?
Yeah. Like, you know, paying for more postcards, advertising on Google. They don't get no deals. So that's the downside to it. And I think that's what separates the strong companies from the guys that are just trying to get in the game.
What percentage of your... Ultimately, whatever number you make, what percentage goes back into marketing, of course?
You know, we kind of have like a fixed number, and I'm be real honest with you. Like, at one point, it was pretty much half of everything that comes in was going back. Now we're at the point where we have so many organic leads coming just from my brand, from Instagram. People just bring me deals. You know, I've kind of made a name for myself in my area, so people know if I got a deal in Inland Empire, I take it to Chris, and he's gonna get it done. So
got it.
That's changed my business.
So then you would then split that fee with the person that you have a finder's fee you pay to the person?
Or sometimes I'll actually partner with the guy who's going to renovate it and get paid through him. And then I'll pay this guy exactly what he wanted to make. That way they keep the deals coming.
Okay.
The beautiful thing is there's just so many angles, right? I mean, sometimes I'll keep the property. I mean, I have rentals too. Sometimes I say, hey, I'm going to keep this place, you know? Sometimes I might buy it myself.
Do you keep the ones that you like? Is there something like, say, hey, it's cash deposit. I just see an opportunity or no?
Yeah, I mean.
Are you trying to get like, put your hand in the cookie jar?
Yeah, you know, it's like, that's the problem, right? It's like every good deal that wants to come, you're always in the pickle. Do I flip it and make all the money now, or do I keep it for the long term? I try to keep some along the way, but definitely, you know, flipping is our main thing.
What's the downside? So you mentioned one, and I respect that. You said that, hey, a lot of people fail. I'm glad you're honest about that, right? And you said the one reason they fail is they run out of money. They don't have the deep enough pockets to continue to market, and if they don't hit it quick enough, right, they might never get any people to do that. Right. And I guess that's exacerbated by being poor negotiators. So you got to be able to kind of do the max. It's almost like the sales side, the marketing side. The marketing side brings the lead in. The sales side is the negotiation. We have to actually convince someone to sell you the house at the right price, right?
Yeah, you can't be like Grant Cardone and just say you got fish and see if people want to buy them. Doesn't work like that.
Not in the real world.
Not in the real world.
Maybe in his world, but
in this world, when people are not interested, they're not interested.
It's not any world. But I like your candor because you're being very honest about the whole thing. So I think that the thing that you just did that just kind of diffused any suspicion. You're just being flat out. People are. It's not as easy as it seems. But I want to. What is it? Because to me, I guess okay. So I can imagine how easy it would be for them to negotiate, right? Because I'm like you, right?
Natural. Yeah.
So it would be to me. It seems like maybe I should do this, but you know I'm kind of busy. But what? There's got to be more to it than that. I think there's probably. Are there any traps to this whole thing? Like you know, like where you think maybe you think something is worth more than it is. Can you get stuck like that with a bad decision?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like on the valuation side of the equation. What else? What are the traps of it all?
So you know.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Right?
No, I know exactly what you're saying. New people have a tendency to put properties under contract that are bad deals and then they can't sell them. And then they end up having to back out of the contract. And if you have a homeowner that's got like an upcoming foreclosure or something bad, you could really get them in a wreck. So you're playing with people's livelihoods.
Let me give you a different take on this. I'll tell you what I think is the biggest problem in this whole thing. All right. The reason that people who get into this and don't have the legs to stay the course end up probably losing their shirt or simply just don't make money is because it's not just this industry, it's any industry you go into, whether it's Hollywood, whether it's real estate, whether it's wholesaling freaking dry goods, like trying to find closeouts of dry goods. What happens is that when you first enter into the market, you're the new guy in the block, what do you see most of? You see all the shit deals that couldn't get done because guys like you already cherry picked all the good ones. So it's like the people who have been in it for a while, they're like taking the good deals as they come in. And then you walk in and what do you see? A portfolio of shit. Mm-hmm. You see the scripts that the great producers wouldn't make because they weren't quite commercial. So you don't really, since you're an SA, oh, that script looks pretty good, but that's because Paramount passed, Warner Brothers passed, you know, all those guys passed. So in any industry you go into, when you first walk in, there's a stable of stuff that didn't get done because it shouldn't have gotten done. And you have to essentially fight the temptation not to just take what you see because it's probably shit that's there. In other words, because the guys that have been in it for all cherry pick, you have to almost wait. And even if, by the way, even when, watch what happens. Let's say you go through a separation with your girlfriend and you're suddenly single. And you go out into the dating market. What do you find? All the crazy, wacky girls who can't get laid or can't find a boyfriend, right? It takes a little time until the good ones get out of relationships and they come back on the market and the fresh ones
come.
No, it's not just in real estate. Yeah. It's in anything that you do. So I think the danger here for someone entering the market is precisely that, is that when you first go in, what you're going to see here is a portfolio of mostly shit.
Yeah.
Okay? Because guys that have been in it have cherry-picked. You have to be patient, right?
It's so funny that you say that because I work with a lot of trainees that I try to, you know, mentor and get done. And it's funny because sometimes someone will bring us a deal like, oh, we're working on this deal. And we look at it and we're like, oh, fuck, we've talked to that guy.
Exactly.
Nobody wants that deal.
We've seen that. He thinks it's the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah,
right?
a bunch of land in 29 Palms. Nobody cares about that.
There you go. Right. And that's what happens.
Yeah,
so one of the big dangers here for people getting into is they have to sort of, you know, you have to have patience here. And I guess it's really important to have a mentor, to have someone that says, so is that what kind of what you do? When you're mentoring someone, are you helping them not make those types of mistakes? Is that an important aspect of what you do?
Yeah. The main value that I bring to my mentees is, on the sales side. I mean, marketing, you know, Jacob's my marketing guy over here. I'm not a strong marketer myself. My expertise is sales, but I do have a strong marketing team with me. So when I work with these mentees, most of the time, they're good at marketing. They get leads.
Sure.
They're just not good at converting. Mm-hmm. And they run the numbers and they offer too much money and mm-hmm. they have preconceived notions about what the seller's thinking. Like, oh, there's no way he's going to take that low offer. And I try to teach them, hey, you're not making offers. We're trying to get numbers out of people. From there, we play the negotiation game, sure. right? And that's what I really try to teach because that's what gets these guys deals. I mean, most of these guys I work with, they have leads. They're just not converting.
And how about the rehab side? So is there any shortage of guys out there looking to rehab these properties? And also, what dictates what they're ultimately willing to pay? In other words, there's the other side of the equation too, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're flipping
to the rehabber,
well, the rehab is trying to negotiate you down on the other side, isn't he?
To a certain degree, until you build relationships. Okay. So like with...
But for a new guy, I mean, he gets into it, right? He's got the same issue, right?
He's got
the other guy saying, that's worth less, blah, 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 blah,
right? Right, yeah. It's, you know, I hate to say it, but it's just, you know, the bigger guys, they have all the perks, right? It's like my rehabbers, they love me. I'm the golden goose. I'm the guy with the deals. Uh-huh. They can't bully me around because they know I don't need you. It's easy to find someone with money that wants to rehab a house. It's not easy to find someone like me that has all these off-market deals.
I guess.
New guys are challenged with that, though. And then when they finally do get a deal, you're right. They talk to a rehabber. They get bullied into, you know, well, what do you got it in contract for? How much are you? Oh, you're making $40,000. Oh, no. I'll give you 10 and take the deal. And most of them panic and they do it. So I try to teach them little strategies on how to like disposition the property and how to like hold their ground when they're negotiating with these guys. And I tell them in the long run, if you build a relationship with two or three big guys, that's all you need. Mm. I would say, you know, I have one guy this year that probably bought over 60 of my houses mm-hmm. and we got a great relationship. He texts me. He probably texts me right now.
Hey, symbiotic.
Yeah.
No, I get it.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Capital wise, it seems like there's, well, the only capital required really is on the marketing side of the equation. Do you teach any guerrilla strategies that where there's no money required? So let's say someone's got no money and wants to get in this industry.
Yeah.
Do you teach them how to do that? Or the reality is you got to have some money.
So I tell people like this. I say, look, can you go get a deal with no money? Yes. But is that really a plan for success? You know, some of these guys say, hey, like, what if I just drive around all day and look for distressed properties? Or if, you know, put out signs. I try to tell people you're better off spending your time trying to round up some capital to do it the right way.
Sure.
That's my take on it. Doesn't mean you can't go get a deal with no money. You can.
How much capital is required, you think?
I mean,
for someone to really start, if you wanted to like be, for someone to like, you know, great shot, you know, you're almost ensuring your success. Right. If you're going to have, let's assuming they can figure out the negotiation side, they can align themselves with a good rehab person. What type of capital do you really need?
So I get this question a lot, and this is the answer I always tell everybody. And it sounds funny, but I say, you know, it's the more the merrier. It's like someone saying, I want to get in shape. How many times should I go to the gym? Mm-hmm. Like, go to the gym every fucking day. You mm-hmm. work out hard, right? If you have the money to put up, put it all up, go mm-hmm. big. You're not going to get traction going small. But that being said, we could work around a budget. So, I mean, ideally, like if you got 5 or 10 grand would be a good start, you know, not that you need that much. I know guys have got their first deal for free just by cold calling people. It does happen. But a good plan would be some kind of revolving budget monthly, you know, $5,000-$10,000 a month, every month. And you have to have the capital to stay in it for a few months to get it going because, you know, it might be 3 or 4 months before you get the ball rolling. Then you finally get a deal and then, you know, you got more money to spend. It takes time.
And how much does what's the profit on a typical deal? It's a loaded
tough
question because you have your home runs that make the whole thing work, right?
Right.
On a typical non-home run deal, what would you say a fair profit is?
Over 15 and under 20,000.
Okay, so 15 to 20 grand a house, right?
Yeah.
And on a home run deal, you can make 100 grand, 50 grand, 70, 200 grand,
300 grand. I've had them for 400 grand. I've had big ones. But those are far few in between.
Sure.
You know, on average, I would say less than 30,000. And that's here in this market too. I mean, I have friends that flip houses in North Carolina and Memphis.
$8,000,
right.
$10,000, sure.
Right. And then we still get deals like that here too. I mean, we get sometimes where it's like, oh man, this deal sucks and we make 4 grand, but it's still 4 grand. You know,
$4,000 is $4,000.
Yeah.
You're not laying out capital, right?
No, I'm not like nothing crazy, no.
Well, I mean, there's you're flipping, you're mid.
Oh, yeah.
No. So now on the advertising side, you're the marketing guy? Who's the marketing guy? So what do you think, I'm going to ask him off. So,
name's Jacob.
Jacob. So let's see here. What's the, he's going to probably, you'll whisper to him because he's not on the.
Oh, no, he's good.
No, because he's not on a microphone. But in terms of for marketing, where do you recommend people market online? Facebook, Google?
All of it. If you can't, all of it.
Organic marketing where you're just posting on your own, you know.
Our biggest marketing channels, well, now it's social media just from, you know, my social media. But Aside from that, it's Google and it's direct mail. Those are our best ones. But we do cold call people. We do send voicemail broadcasts and text blasts and all that.
Do you think this is a good second or third income source? Or is it something that's best done full time?
You know, I guess it depends on the person's situation. Like if you have the, you can do it part-time, but if you really start getting leads in, you got to tend to those leads. It does take quite a bit of time. I find that most guys have a job, they have money, they get into it. Once they get a few deals, their goal is to try to quit their job. You know, mm-hmm. It's not as easy as it sounds though, right? Sure. It's not as easy as it sounds.
And do you recommend that you stay within your own geographic area where you live or that you can drive to? Or is it okay to, let's say you're in an area like North Carolina or Kentucky, where simply the margins are going to be lower by virtue of being lower priced real estate, would you recommend going outside your own area into higher priced areas?
I would. You know, I like my area just because it's my area and California's high dollar houses, right? I've done deals in other states. It's just not really my thing. But I guess at the end of the day, I think most people would be more comfortable in their own backyard because they know the area, they know the neighborhoods. Maybe you might be able to go to like local real estate meetups and meet some buyers and figure out what they're looking for, kind of reverse engineer the whole thing. But if it was me and I lived out of state somewhere, I would definitely be doing deals here in California because this is where the big deals come from.
Okay. Let's go talk about your actual event now. Right. So you started off, you're the first one. And so when was the first one?
It was in July. It's not that long ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And you succeeded?
Yeah, it was a smash hit. And
how many people attended ultimately?
150.
Okay, wow. Yeah, that's great, yeah. Right? And now you're doing it again. I'm going to be speaking there, which is great. We're we'll have a lot of fun, right? We're teaching some closing strategies, negotiation, right?
Yeah.
And what's your plan for you? What's like, where do you see your business going to? So you have the tool business continues to run, you said, right?
Oh, yeah.
And that's just a solid income generator for you?
And that's my, excuse me, that's my main thing, you know? I mean, that's where I'm at all day, every day.
Sure.
I'm at the tool company. My dad works there. My family works there. I love all my guys there. I mean, that's where I'm at all day, every day.
But what you have to offer to the world, though, I think, is this, right?
Yeah. My training salesman is my strong point, right? I mean, in the tool business, I've gone on to train, you know, tons of 6 and 7 figure producers. And now I built my real estate company pretty much from scratch overnight, it seems like. And I got guys making a bunch of money over there. When I did the first event, I realized it was like a new calling. You know, I says, hey, this is something I'm good at. Something's natural for me. I enjoy it. You know, I like when the people text me later and say, oh, I used your price drop technique and I made $12,000 or I did this and that, you know? And it's like, even having you at my event is like a big deal. We're sitting in my jacuzzi and we're like, it'd be badass if we can get Jordan Belfort to come.
I'm in.
And I was like, you know what? I'm gonna fucking figure out a way to get Jordan Belfort to come. Did I not? Right? Literally like that. And then bam, here we are.
I'm a capitalist. There we go. Right? No, so I love speaking. I love mentoring. And you're right. There's no better feeling that, and I get this so many times a day. People write me or tell me, mm-hmm. Oh my God, I use your straight line. I can't believe it. It changed my life. That's great. It's a great feeling, right? You married?
Yeah, married.
Children?
I just had a baby on the 10th.
Wow.
Yeah.
The 10th of this month?
This month, yeah. Last
Holy
week.
Christ.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So let me see a picture. You have a picture on you?
You got my phone, Jay? Yeah. I raised my stepdaughter from 9 till she's 18.
I raised one too. He's amazing. And so
she's still my baby too, but the new baby's here.
Oh my God. Really cute. Look at this guy.
Thanks, man. Yeah. So now I want to work less. I got to figure out a way to work less and make more now.
I like it. That's phenomenal.
Thanks,
man. And you live where?
In Riverside.
Riverside. Awesome. So here's what we're going to do now. We're going to stop the actual film portion right now. So guys, follow this on either Spotify, iTunes, wherever you listen to your podcast. So the YouTube portion is over. Now we're going to get to the down and dirty stuff off of YouTube. All right. So tell me about your vices. What kind of guy are you?
My vices.
So you strike me as a really clean cut sort of normal guy. Do you have a dark side at all?
You know, I'm kind of a square. I don't really have a dark side other than that, you know, growing up as a kid, I suffered from a lot of depression.
The last guy who said that to me ended up being coming this close to shooting up a school. So let's see where this ends up.
No.
Am I making that up or not? The last guy said, I have no dark side at all. Then 5 minutes later, he goes, well, there was this one time when I took an M16 to my public school and came this close to blowing away everyone. I was like, Okay.
All right, you gotta go.
I don't seem like that. That he was a nice guy as well. He just had some bad moments, I guess. But
I grew up with dealing with depression issues. Never did no drugs, nothing like that. I didn't even start drinking until I was 23. I'm 35. So I was kind of like, for one reason or another, I never had that type of issue.
Women?
No. I've always been the girlfriend guy. Like, that's just how I was raised. You know, my mom and dad been married forever. Their mom and dads are married forever. You know, I've been with my wife we've been together 10 years, you know. I met her and got engaged in 90 days. That's how I am, you know.
Hopeless romantic?
I don't know. I don't know what to say. I'm just keeping it real. I mean, that's just the kind of guy I am. If I have any vice today, it would probably be that I drink too much now. You know, always celebrating a victory or a stress day. I like whiskey.
Whiskey?
Yeah, I like whiskey, but it's not a problem or nothing, you know? But that's my thing. I do like to have a drink here and there. Probably going to go have a drink after we get out of here, you know? But yeah, growing up as a kid, lots of depressed times.
Why do you think you were depressed?
I think because of circumstance, you know, growing up poor, and I was always looking at things I wanted that I couldn't do. And, you know, I have a younger brother and I was always thinking, man, I wish I could do stuff with him, and we never had no money. I just was just a depressed kid. But, you know, I grew out of it in my 20s. You know, I've started making money and I realized that doesn't fix anything, right? And that was an awakening, you know. I was like, oh man, now I'm making money and I'm still depressed.
Right.
I'm more depressed. Now I have more to lose. You know, just like I had to change my whole mindset.
And what do you think was the shift that allowed you to do? Did you make a shift in there in the mindset? What was it?
You know, I got two very good men in my life. You know, my dad, he's always gave me really good advice. And then my mentor, who's also now my partner in the tool business, you know, he's kind of guided me from growing up. When I first started my company in the tool biz, he owned the parent company. So it was basically like I had all these salesmen and they bought the paper. That's the relationship, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of mentored me along the way. And eventually he ended up buying me out and we merged, and that's how we are today. But that guy is, you know, just really good friend of mine. And he kind of like helped me growing up. And he would always tell me, you know, like, see, now you're making money, but it doesn't solve anything. You know, you got to stay balanced and you got to live in the now a little bit and not always be chasing the next shiny thing, and just kind of guided me growing up. But yeah, I think somewhere around my late 20s, I just figured it out one day. You know, I got married and, you know, I was raising my stepdaughter and everything was good and we're making money. And I'm just like, you know, you just got to stop and smell the roses sometime and shit's not that bad, you know?
All right, listen, so when is the actual date of this event here? I thought I saw something before. Where did it go?
January.
It's formally announced this. Let's see if we can get some more people to attend, as they should. It's going to be an awesome event.
Yeah.
Who should attend?
You know, anybody that's looking to sharpen their sales skills, especially in real estate. I mean, we have agents and brokers and fix and flippers and wholesalers. I mean, specifically, it's mainly for wholesalers.
There we go.
But, yeah. But everybody comes, you know.
January 24th to 26th, the W Hotel.
Beautiful venue.
I got a real freaking problem with the W right now.
Do you?
Yeah, they overcharged my credit card $65,000 last week.
Thanks.
$65,000. W, unless you refund it, I'm going to keep mentioning this every single day on every platform until you give me back the money you took from my credit card without authorization. And if after this podcast, I find that you already did during this podcast, I will delete this out. You'll never know I said this. Otherwise, I'm going to say it again next week.
And the week after.
Yeah. The week after.
That's funny. Kidding.
Anyway, but no, seriously, the 24th, 26th, it is a nice venue. Definitely attend this event. I'm going to be there teaching all my best stuff. This guy's an animal. He's got a lot to teach people, a lot to offer.
Yeah, they're going to be blown away. It's going to be, I mean, this is a fun conversation, but you know, it's totally different when we got the PowerPoints and we're in the zone. It's going to be awesome.
No, you did a really good job explaining and being honest about the industry. I respect that. Thank you. I'm looking forward to speaking it.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome. All right, guys, enjoy. Share this with your friends, your relatives, your brothers, your sisters, your aunts, your uncles. Everybody else in the world should listen to this particular podcast every week. The Wolf's Den.
Agreed.